Good morning. This morning begins part two of a three-part series entitled The Neglected Fields of Spirituality. Part one was entitled something like Healing the False Selves Within, if you remember. One of the neglected fields of spirituality having to do with the inner self. And we explored that inner self by using the metaphors of development, of personal development from child, adolescent to adult. And attempted to look at those within the context of spirituality. Today, I would like to speak about another neglected field of spirituality, and I use field in the very metaphorical and concrete sense of that term, not as an abstract object of study, but field as a place wherein we live and we observe, and a place wherein we grow, the sense of field. Of a living place. And the neglected field of spirituality is certainly nature. Today's lesson will be entitled The Nature of God and the God of Nature. Most of you have with you one of the prayers, poems designed and written by the UN Environmental Sabbath Program. I would like to begin our service today, if we could, by reading together. Those of you who may not have one, please look on the page with someone else. Does everyone have that? On top of the page, it should say Earth Prayers. Okay? Let's read together. We have forgotten who we are. We have forgotten who we are. We have alienated ourselves from the unfolding of the cosmos. We have become estranged from the movements of the earth, and we have turned our backs on the cycles of life. We have forgotten who we are. We have sought only our own security. And we have exploited simply for our own ends. And we have distorted our knowledge. And we have abused our power. We have forgotten who we are. Now the land is barren, and the waters are poisoned, and the air is polluted. We have forgotten who we are. Now the forests are dying. And the creatures are disappearing, and humans are despairing. We have forgotten who we are. We ask forgiveness. We ask for the gift of remembering. And we ask for the strength to change. We have forgotten who we are. I was very struck by this prayer, by this poem, and when I speak to you today of the nature of God and the God of nature, I believe that the answer to this riddle, perhaps, is the fact that we have forgotten who we are. And I think all of us who are here today are searchers. We are attempting to find out who we are. And I think that that's so crucial, a journey. In fact, one could define very simply the spiritual journey as a lifelong journey of finding out who we are. I think the humility of this prayer saying that we have forgotten who we are. And the result of that is an incredible disorder in our universe, in the natural order of the universe. Is a symbol, is a reflection, is a mirror that we have forgotten who we are. And so today will be a simple and yet perhaps profound reflection on this question, who we are. Robert Hunter in O Season, O Castles says, in nature, there is no such thing as the clash of colors. It is not so much that things flow into each other. Rather, it is that there is only one thing out there. And somehow, it is not really out there. Somehow, it is in here, too, inside. In the Oglala Lakota elder, Noble Red Man, said, God is nature, and nature is God. I've been reading in that wonderful text edited by Rick Fields a number of years ago, Chop Wood, Carry Water, a text which I recommend for everyone who wish an introduction shall we say, the new old spirituality, because it's as old as the ages, and yet it's new for some of us. They have a wonderful insight in this book that suggests that perhaps it was not human beings who were kicked out of the garden by God, but that God was kicked out of the garden by human beings. And so what has happened is the sacred nature of things in the earth are unavailable to us. And we see things in nature as things to be dominated, organized. We don't see the living, sacred aspect of all nature and all things. We do not see the face of God in things anymore. And so we are the ones who have kicked God out of nature, not that we were kicked out of nature, out of the garden by God. Very, very powerful insight. This morning, I simply am going to reflect to and fro about this notion and what might it look like if we do begin to see and begin to feel two things, not only the face of God in nature, but something much more radical, which I'm going to get to, much more radical than that. Because I think a lot of us are already seeing that intellectually, you know, looking at nature and seeing beauty or seeing the order and harmony of the universe, etc. But there's something more radical that is being implied here. In Chop Wood, Carry Water, I love how this wonderful sentence, Patanjali, Buddha, Moses, and Jesus did not go to workshops or seminars or even churches. They went to nature. Right? Buddha discovering enlightenment under the Bodhi tree. Jesus on the mountaintop. Patanjali in a cave. And they talk about, in Chop Wood, Carry Water, that civilizations for thousands of years had been living on the inspiration of these masters who went to nature to read the book of God. And we sort of worn it out. We squeezed everything possible out of it. And now it's time that we return ourselves. And once we do, we begin to discover, if we're open enough, an amazing mystery, which I'm going to get to. An amazing mystery of who we are and who nature is. that nature is no longer a what but a who. Patrick Moore, one of the great ecologists of our time, has developed what he's called the three laws of ecology. And basically, it's pretty simple, these three laws of ecology, but very, very important for us, perhaps. The first law is that all forms of life are interdependent. All forms of life are interdependent. The second law is that stability, unity, harmony of all ecosystems is dependent on their diversity, on their complexity, on their multiplicity. And that the third law is that all resources are limited. Food, water, air, minerals, energy. There are limits to the growth of all living systems if we do not follow the laws. Or if we do follow them, there are limits. The one that I think is necessary for us more than any other is that all forms of life are interdependent, the first law and the second, that stability in our planet and stability for all of us as people, harmony, unity, is dependent on diversity. In other words, the more stable systems have more species. The less stable systems have less. Patrick Moore developed his three laws of ecology from Hegel's great system, but of course Hegel just took it from Plato. Hegel once said that all of philosophy was just a footnote on Plato. That we were talking about the great notion of the one and the many, but I think for many of us, we've been keeping all this in our head. If we do admit to the notion of diversity and individuality, and that this is good, and yet interdependency, what this talks about is an ethos, doesn't it? We're talking about an ethic here of living together, of not being judgmental, of not saying there's only one truth or one form of belief or one way of living, that there are many. And we need to, for the survival of ourselves, our planet, all of the things in the world, we need to come together and allow each of these diverse cultures to give the gifts, to bring the gifts at the table and to work together. So this notion of the stability of the planet is dependent upon the diversity of it. That means we can no longer talk about there is one truth or there is one better way, but perhaps there are many, many better ways. But we've lost our whole sense of this, haven't we? We've lost our whole sense of even what beautiful is. We've lost our whole sense of what good is or what truth is. And, you know, all we need to do is go here or go there and someone will tell us this is the truth, the good, the beautiful. All the rest is not, right? And our planet gets sicker. And our planet gets sicker. But it was James Lovelock in the Gaia Hypothesis. I think it was somewhere around 1975, many years ago, 17 years ago, who gave us a radical hypothesis about who Earth was, who Gaia was, the Greek's mother goddess Gaia. And very, very simply, he said that the entire range of living matter on Earth, from whales to bacteria and from oaks to algae, could be regarded as constituting a single living entity. What that suggests and implies is, Lovelock ventures, is that all human life is the mind, the brain, the nervous system of nature. We are the hope of Mother Earth. We are the spokespersons of Mother Earth who can only speak silently. We are the nervous system highly evolved and the brain and mind highly evolved of nature. That's pretty powerful. That's pretty radical. There is only one reality then. I would add to Lovelock's term of we are the brain and nervous system, I mean, we are the heart, the highly developed heart of nature. So the insight even of Robert Hunter is pretty radical when we look at it, because his connection, when he was looking at nature, he saw one being living, moving in and out of one another. One being. He allowed nature to speak to him. He allowed the movement and dynamic of plant and animal to speak to him, and he realized that it was one being. And he himself was looking at nature, and yet nature was looking back. Silently speaking, as Rilke talked about, the great poet, the German poet, of the early 20th century, that the beings of nature silently ask us to speak them more intensely than they could ever be spoken, because they do not have a voice like ours. But this is a radical, radical change, if you will, or a shift in consciousness. To suggest then that all the plants outside, all of the animals outside, all of the light, all of energy, all of matter, as Théo de Chardin knew, the Jesuit priest, when he said Mass on the mountaintop, and then later taken to Rome for heresy. But he went to the mountaintop to have Mass. Not in the church, nor in the temple, the Jesuit priest, and said, this is the bread, this is the Eucharist, all of the universe is. Matter is alive. It is the universe that is the very mind and heart, if you will, of being. And so who are we if we have forgotten who we are? What these marvelous folks are suggesting to us is that one of the neglected fields of spirituality, being nature, is precisely that which will tell us something of who we are. But not abstractly, not in terms of some kind of philosophy, but a living, breathing entity. So there is no multiplicity that is separate and totally isolated from ourselves called nature. But we are nature, nature is us. That's pretty radical. An insight, but only one that can be gotten us. Only one that can enrapture us if we allow nature to extremely, extremely connect with us at an emotional level. At an emotional level, not only at the level of mind. It is this Gaia hypothesis of Lovelock that I found quite fascinating. Because our culture has done the opposite in terms of its domination of nature. We see that there's a lot of neurosis going on. There's even neurosis in animals. There's neurosis in nature. And the neurosis is sort of the disconnection, the symptom of disconnection from ourselves and our soul. That's probably what neurosis is all about. We're out of order. That's what probably dis-easiness is all about. We're out of connection. We've lost our connection to the whole notion of soul as embedded in body, embedded in nature, embedded in the very core of living and breathing matter, but also even connected to the things that we craft, to the things that we make, our expressions of our soul and our level of soulfulness. So the Gaia hypothesis suggests then that if we are nature, the mind, nervous system of nature, and I would suggest even that we are the very highly evolved heart of nature, then what follows from that then is that we, involved with nature in the animal kingdom, in this planet, are the very body of God. Perhaps that's what Genesis was talking about when they said man and woman are made in the image and likeness of God. That we are the body of God, the image of God, the reflection of God embodied in matter. The becoming character of God that is forever changing, that is forever going out into the many and back into the one. The pulsing and vibrating movement of life going into the many and then back into the one, whereby death and life are all of a piece. That there is a cycle, if you will, of life, and that we have we've disconnected ourselves from this cycle of life. So the first thing that we can do is begin observing nature, but not observing nature coolly as scientists, but observing nature as we would our hand. Or observing nature as we would our eye. Observing nature as we would the intricacies and fabric of our mind and psyche. Observing nature as we would observe a lover. Observing nature as we would something that we treasured and something that we saw as sacred and divine. Observing nature and allowing nature, as the great ancient masters have said, to teach us. To teach us how to be again. Because nature exists without judgment, without opinion, with full integrity, with power, with destruction, with construction, with creativity. Nature has it all, but it also has a certain balance to it, a certain moving in and moving out. And the ancient masters teach us, especially the Oriental ones, along with Jesus, that we are out of tune with that balance. And we need to allow nature once again to teach us. Very, very powerful. The physician, the 16th century physician, Paracelsus, said, "The physician is only the servant of nature, not her master. It behooves medicine to follow the will of nature." Behooves medicine to follow the will of nature. What is the will of nature? I have been talking a lot about Thomas More's recent book called The Care of the Soul in the last couple of months or so. And Thomas More has a wonderful chapter at the end of his book, In the Care of the Soul, about the world soul, the soul of the world. We need to allow, once again, our minds to be open to the fact that there is a world soul, or we will not see the sickness of ourselves in the world. Very, very radical. But it was something that the ancients understood. Certainly Plato, Aristotle, understood that this whole notion of world soul. But when I had my first philosophy classes in 1973, but it had been so long ago, this was something that was in my mind. It was something in my mind when I looked at Aristotle and Plato and they talked about the world. So it was a cold, cool diagram, right? Of the world. That somehow the world had a soul that lived and breathed was absolutely not accessible to me, because I had not yet discovered the heart of nature, and I had not allowed nature to discover my heart. So I existed in my mind with such things. Thomas More tells us that we project constantly personality onto things But what happens is that it lands us deeply in our ego. We don't allow things to be who they are. We like to project what we want onto things and what we see onto things. And we are missing the boat. Right? We want animals to be, I mean, my God, where were we? Allison, we were looking at something and we saw this place and that they were selling like caps for dogs and sweaters and stuff like that. Very bizarre. You know? Or how about just looking at the notion of our lawns, our yards? Anybody here live in suburbia? Our lawns, you know? I mean, these things, a lawn, in the original sense of the term, we can go to Savannah and see memories of the lawns and all the squares. Those were originally lawns for sheep and cattle. A lawn was an open field where animals ate on and families had for this process. So that one would have these animals so that one could eat. So the lawn, the green yard that now we have mowers rather than sheep, very bizarre. Okay? No wonder why we have a lack of sense of soul and there's a lack of sense of beauty, you see. And we try to shape things according to our own image of things. You know, you can still go to England today and see these incredible gardens that are shaped into these leaves of trees are shaped into roosters, you know, and cattle. Strange things like that. We're projecting what we, you know, it's this kind of control and manipulation of nature. It's very bizarre. But I know there was always something I felt when I looked outside at the lawn that was freshly cut. And I know I hated it at some deep level, but I always remember I liked the smell of freshly mowed grass. Yeah. Well, you get the same smell when sheep and cattle are grazing on that grass. Just go to any farm. And once the grass is cut into by the incisors of the teeth, the smell of that grass, one will be very much connected to, you see. And that's why we smell the mowed grass, because the cold blade of the mechanical mower has cut it. And so we're smelling that process. But the original square, the original lawn, it was amazing when I found that out in Savannah, because I loved these squares and I went from square to square. They have 20 squares. Little did I know that these were all original plots, and the back, these squares were lawns where they kept sheep and cattle so that they could graze. So the grass was cut, of course, by the cattle. Now, of course, we tried to do that today, right? If I bought some cattle and goats and said I'm not going to use a lawnmower anymore, you know, I don't know if that would work. But it's the point of where we've come, I think. We need to look at this, have a sense of what we've lost. Thomas More says we need to grant the world its soul again. I think it needs to be much more radical than that. I think we have to come to the point of saying that the natural world has granted me my soul. And that the soul is but a highly advanced form of the world soul, potentially. In fact, we could almost define soul as the spiritual connection between myself and everything. That which connects me to the vital way that the parts of my body are interconnected. Are you with me? That perhaps at some level, the soul is the very connection that I have between myself and everything. In nature, me, you, what I make, what is made. That's a bit more radical. But that's beginning to make more sense to me. Because we have to have sort of a radical picture so that when Plato talks to us of God as the One and talks to us of beauty, right? Then we get the sense that this One is not some kind of abstract metaphysics. But the One is the living connectedness and interdependence between ourselves, one another, nature, the cosmos, you see. And of course, at a deep level, then we could say the very creator of that, the very primordial creator of that, which some of us call God or highest power, right? Or the Zen Buddhist called the Tao, right?
or Jesus calls the Father. The Greeks called the father and mother goddesses, okay, or Zeus. Being the highest, if you will, the highest power of the Greek world of life. But there's this kind of interconnectedness of things at an emotional level. Then I then will regard everything outside of me as if I were going to regard my hand or my foot or my leg. You see what I'm saying? Then I would be living in my world in a totally different way, in a totally different ethos. But that takes a sense of love, a sense of openness, you see. We have, as I think I've said to you before, we have to move from biology, logos, bio, the study of life, or the word of life, to bioeros. Bioeros. Correct. The love of life, or biophilos, rather than biology. Because then, at the level of feeling, then I have an investment, don't I? Only when I have an emotional investment do things really become alive for me. Become alive for me. And then I begin to be at the right place in the right time. It's interesting enough, too. I always get to be at the right place at the right time when I become emotionally invested in a place. I love that. Someone comes for a meeting and says, they spoke to me exactly what I needed to hear. Well, of course, because you were emotionally aligned. Right? Or I ended up being right where I needed to be at that time. Of course, because if you're emotionally alive and really feeling and allowing things to be in their feeling and not attempting to grasp and control, and we'll talk about that. What does addiction in this world soul have to say to one another? If we're not doing injustice to our world by trying to change it, then we will begin to understand and feel that wherever we are at the right place if we are emotionally alive. If we are searching for relatedness, if we are searching, one could even say, for beauty. Thomas More also talks about the fact that isn't it amazing that at different times in our history, we've always denied soul to classes of beings we've wanted to control. We've always denied soul to classes of beings we didn't want to control. Even in the New Testament. In the Old Testament, the slaves were those without soul. And in America, when we brought the men and women of color here, when men and women of European ancestry decided to utilize slaves for our economic growth, we believe that slaves had no soul. Anything that one dominates and controls will be soulless. I'm wondering whether, in many respects, drug addiction and addictions to all processes are but a symptom the soullessness in the world, a symptom of our disconnectedness from world soul. I think more needs to be said about this. Process addiction is against the development of world soul. It is this development of intimacy in the world and growth of the world. It breeds disconnection from the awareness that the world is me and I am the world. Does that make sense? And we need to look at this more deeply, I believe. But I believe that the world of addiction, in act, is precisely an example of our disconnection from the fact that I am nature and nature is me.
Last thing I have to share with you is I sort of went through the ages and using everything from New Testament scriptures to Taoism to the poetry of Walt Whitman. And I was just amazed at how they were saying the same thing about our need to recognize, perhaps, that the nature of God is precisely the God of nature, that they are the same thing, and that perhaps we, at one level, are the very body of God. And until we recognize and allow nature to teach us, we will continually be out of balance, out of order. In the 6th century, Lao Tzu said, "The ancient masters were profound and subtle. Their wisdom was unfathomable. There is no way to describe it. All we can describe is their appearance." So what does Lao Tzu then say, this 6th century master? He says, "The ancient masters were careful as someone crossing an iced over stream." Recognize nature is being talked about here, right? "Alert as a warrior in enemy territory. Courteous as a guest. Fluid as melting ice. Shapeable as a block of wood. Receptive as a valley. And clear as a glass of water. Can you remain unmoving till the right action arises by itself? Not seeking, not expecting. Welcoming all things." This ancient master has observed nature and recognizes this kind of patience at the very ground of nature. Sengsan in the 7th century said about the mind of absolute trust. He says, "Don't get entangled in the world. Don't lose yourself in emptiness. Be at peace in the oneness of things, and all errors will disappear by themselves." I would go so far as to say is, when we recognize the oneness of all things, loneliness, my dear friends, will disappear. If we recognize the oneness of all things, that I am part of the very body of nature, that you and me are the very mind and brain of all of nature, how can we be alone? We can only be alone when we are disconnected from nature and disconnected from the soul of nature. Isn't this profound? "Returning to the root, you find meaning," Sengsan says. "Chasing appearances, you lose their source. Don't keep searching for the truth. Just let go of your opinions." You see, when I'm opinionated and judgmental, what I get in touch with the two-ness of life, not the oneness of life. The two-ness. The object. This is right. This is wrong. This is good. This is evil. This is black. This is white, etc. If I get in touch with the two-ness, the great dualistic sickness of our age, the two-ness of life, I then lose this notion of the real truth that exists only in the interrelationship of the world. Einstein knew that. Right? The interrelatedness of the world. "For the mind in harmony with the indivisible unity," which is the Tao, don't worry about that word, "with not even a trace of self-doubt, you can trust the universe completely." I say this to all of you who have any kind of anxiety or depression or experience any of this. May this be good news to all of you, in the back row especially. "With not even a trace of self-doubt, you can trust the universe completely in the world of things as they are. The best you can say is not to. Nothing in the world is excluded. The enlightened of all times and places have entered into this truth. Infinity is right before your eyes." Doesn't that sound, Jimmy, like Jesus? Infinity is right before your eyes. "One is all and all are one. When you realize this, what reason for holiness or wisdom? The mind of all of absolute trust is beyond holiness and wisdom. It is perfectly at peace." And remember Ecclesiastes. "There is a season for everything, a time for every occupation under heaven, a time for giving birth, a time for dying, a time for planting, a time for uprooting what has been planted, a time for knocking down, a time for building." All of you folks who are against therapy and, you know, trying to defend your ego, right? Against all odds. "A time for tears, a time for laughter. A time for mourning, a time for dancing, a time for embracing, a time to refrain from embracing sexual addicts, a time for searching, a time for losing,
a time for tearing and a time for sowing, a time for keeping silent and a time for speaking. You might listen to that when you're in groups next time. Those of you who are silent and you never talk, begin sharing. Those of you who are hyperverbal and don't know when to shut up, a time for keeping silent and a time for speaking. You see, the author of Ecclesiastes, and this was written probably around 300 BCE before the Common Era, the wisdom literature of the Old Testament, huh? Proverbs, Wisdom, Ecclesiastes, etc. This author had a profound sense of the balance of life and the cycles of seasons. Time for giving birth and a time for dying. Amazing. If we only realize that, you see, when we began to feel like we're losing it, it can be very good. Because we'll only get it again if we recognize that that's what nature is all about. That's what the heart of nature is. And don't forget Jesus in Matthew 6, 1 through 14. He actually echoes the Chinese Oriental master that says the mind of absolute trust is precisely who God is. Jesus says, that is why I'm telling you not to worry about your life and what you are to eat, not about your body and what you are to wear. Surely life is more than food and the body more than clothing. Look at the birds in the sky. This is Jesus, the person who goes back to nature, right? He doesn't go in any text, written text that is cool and mechanical. He goes to the very book of God that is in nature. He says, look at the birds in the sky. They do not sow or reap or gather into barns. Are you not worth much more than they are? Can any of you, however much you worry, add one single moment to the span of your life? So don't worry. Set your hearts on the kingdom first. I would add, along with this text, the Oriental Chinese master that says, have a mind of absolute trust that all is unfolding as it needs to. I get in the way of the great way. And that's why I have pain and loneliness and division and hate and anger and all of these things, huh? And Wu Min, the Oriental master of the 13th century, said, 10,000 flowers in spring, the moon in autumn, a cool breeze in summer, snow in winter. He says, if your mind isn't clouded by unnecessary things, this is the best season of your life. If your mind isn't clouded by unnecessary things, attached. You see, we're out of sync with nature because when we think of our painful moments or our loneliness or despair or the dying of our life, the cycle of our life, immediately we get real scared, you see. Well, what Wu Min says, we need to let go of that because we're in a cycle. We're in a cycle. We need to let that happen so that we can have life again. We need to be pruned. We need to be pruned. And finally, Walt Whitman in the 19th century. We are nature, spontaneous. We soar above and look down. We it is who balance ourselves, orbic and stellar. We spring on prey. We prowl fanged and four-footed in the woods, and we are seas mingling. We are two of those cheerful waves rolling over each other and interwetting each other. Of course, I've got to add that the sea can be quite powerful, you know. I was out there for about 8 hours doing some deep sea fishing, and I was green the whole time. The power of the water. The power of the water. The humbleness of water. St. Francis knew that. St. Francis said the water was humble, but Lao Tzu also said that. St. Francis called Sister Water so humble. Huh? We are what the atmosphere is, transparent, receptive. We are snow, rain, cold, darkness. We are each product and influence of the globe. We have circled and circled till we have arrived home again. So a good lesson in finding out who we are, Walt Whitman knows about. And we call him a nature poet. It's so absurd, isn't it? That's a nature poet. Whenever we want to kind of understand nature, let's study Walt Whitman. It's so ridiculous. We're so arrogant. Not a nature poet. He's a human being who's awake. Not a nature poet. He understands the relationship.